Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Thanks for joining us here in our second hour of Circles of Change. It's a pleasure, none other, to actually have placed a call to London, England, to Tim Harford. Tim, how are you this morning?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm terrific, and actually, it's a real pleasure. We're meeting today the undercover economist at the Financial Times, one of the world's most widely read financial publications. Tim's writing has also appeared in Esquire, Forbes, New York Magazine, Wired, The Washington Post, and The New York Times here stateside. Our topic today, though, is his new book, Adapt, Why Success Always Starts with Failure, and it's an engaging, provocative, and important exploration of how we can change the world and our own lives one failure at a time. Tim's previous books include The Undercover Economist and The Logic of Life, and he presents the popular BBC radio show More or Less. Tim is a visiting fellow at Nuffield College, Oxford, and a senior visiting fellow at Cass Business School. He's the winner of the 2006 Bastiat Prize for Economic Journalism and the 2010 Royal Statistical Society Award for Excellence in Journalism, which listeners are sure to appreciate why, when today you're going to get a glimpse of Tim's ability to weave together psychology, evolutionary biology, anthropology, physics, and economics to investigate a range of big picture problems. So whether we like it or not, the complexity of the modern world demands adaptive trial and error to create innovations and solve crises both large and small. So with that, Tim, you've got.
I'm looking forward to hearing what I have to say.
Introduction. Very good. Well, I know you've already taken a tour to the United States regarding your book. It was back in May at a variety of settings, from New York to Seattle to San Francisco, at some pretty heady World Affairs Council and the like. What's been the reaction so far to Adapt?
Well, I really enjoyed the way that people have responded to the fact that it's not just a book of ideas, but it's a book of stories. It's a book with heroes in it, and I've really tried to weave the ideas together with those stories and let the characters convey the concepts. But the thing that really struck me was visiting the West Coast and the East Coast of the U.S. Mm-hmm. So when I was speaking, say, at Google in Mountain View, and saying, well, you know, I mean, the basic idea of the book is we've got a lot of complex problems to solve, and they're so complex, we'll make mistakes. And so fixing mistakes is more important than we recognize. You know, we like to tell ourselves that we can get things right first time, and we hardly ever do. So I tell that to Google, and I see a bunch of people nodding and saying, well, absolutely, that's the way we do things here in Silicon Valley.
Exactly.
That's how we do things here at Google. 80% of our products are expected to fail.
And also probably 80% of the people have multiple times raised from the ashes like the phoenix.
Absolutely.
That's just the environment there.
Yeah, no, so they were sort of saying, well, yeah, sure, it's we agree, it's kind of obvious, we agree. And then at the same time, or just a few days earlier, I was in Manhattan. In fact, I was on Wall Street, and everybody was all the buses and the taxis. They had all the posters up advertising the new HBO series called Too Big to Fail.
Exactly.
And I thought, oh, okay, so
that's the juxtaposition here.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. Google say fail faster. Wall Street say, we need another bailout. You can't possibly let us fail. And then you ask yourself which of these two sections of the U.S. economy has contributed more to people's happiness.
Very well put. And that's another one of that is a classic Tim Harford, by the way, is to pose that provocative question that makes everybody go, okay. Well, you started the book out with talking about the humble toaster. And maybe you could power through that real quickly to set the frame for how important this idea is of adaptation.
Well, I just wanted people to appreciate how incredibly complex the society and the economy that we've created are. And so I started with this toaster. It's a wonderful project. A fellow Londoner of mine, Thomas Thwaites, decided he was going to build a toaster from scratch, just to sort of see what it was like. And it took him 9 months, and over, if I remember correctly, almost £1,200, so about $1,800.
Dollars, yeah.
And he, what he ended up with was a toaster that looked kind of like a birthday cake, shaped like a toaster, made by an incredibly drunk cook. And it, of course, it didn't work. It didn't toast. He'd gone to an iron mine to try and get iron. He'd smelted iron in a microwave. He had tried to make plastic out of potato starch. He'd been eaten by snails. I mean, he's just had all these adventures trying to make this incredibly simple thing that you can buy at, say, Walmart for less than 1 hour's wages. And he couldn't do it. It took him almost a year, and he still couldn't do it. And it just demonstrated incredible sophistication of the products in the world around us, and then the sheer number of different products. And if the way I like to put it is, if you imagine counting every different product and service available in, say, the New York, you know, greater economy, so the, you know, major economy of New York, if you were counting every single product and service, taking 1 second to count each one, you wouldn't be done for 317 years.
Exactly.
Because there are over 10 billion different products and services available, and many are far more complex than the toaster. And then you think, wow, there's a whole world out there, and we keep making new stuff. And all I'm doing here is I'm just counting toasters. I'm not trying to solve to the peace process in the Middle East. I'm not dealing with human dynamics. I'm not dealing with the environment. I'm just describing the complexity of the physical economy. It's just an unbelievably complex world, and we tend to gloss over that. If we look at, say, the television, we look at the business news on television, or we look at the newspapers, you know, we often see things summarized in just a few numbers. The Dow Jones was up 2%. Unemployment was X million. We see these few summary statistics, and we kind of think we're seeing the economy, but it's just far more complex than that, complex for any one person to understand.
Well, in fact, of course, you put a pretty compelling story out there with very well researched, talking about how, yes, even really testing, did the experts have it right, you know, or who really are the experts, it makes you want to take pause, particularly because things have changed so much and will continue to do so.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't want to dismiss expertise. If I want my car fixed, I want an expert mechanic. If I'm suffering from, you know, heart trouble, I want to be operated on by an expert heart surgeon. You know, expertise does count for something. But the more complex the problem, the less effective expertise is. Certainly the less effective expertise is at getting the answer right first time. And you know, economic problems, social problems, military problems, environmental problems, you know, whether we're talking about the war in Iraq or regulating the banking system, these are just problems where it's actually all about error correction. It's not about getting it right first time, because you can't. It's all about this process of error correction.
Yes, and of course there's the statistician in you, of course. It's error correction. It's also then knowing that you've got to look at really providing mechanisms to manage the variation. And
yeah,
when you've got so much choice at the same time, those things are at odds at times, aren't they?
I mean, the complexity of the system demands, you know, that we will make mistakes. We need to be able to fix them. But it also means that, you know, mistakes can often be swamped, or they can often be buried. There's a very, very important concept that actually comes from the guys who study industrial accidents. They study, you know, Three Mile Island, Deepwater Horizon. And I talked to these guys because I wanted to use their expertise to understand the banking crisis. I mean, it seems like a surprising connection, but they were all convinced that the connection made sense. And they said, look, one of the key ideas here, Tim, is something called a latent error. And a latent error, somebody makes a mistake, or maybe it's a fraud, maybe it's a deliberate violation of procedures, but, you know, whether it's accidental or deliberate, there's this problem, and it just lies there in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's nobody checked that the blowout preventer on the Deepwater Horizon rig was actually working, because it wasn't. Or maybe it's that somebody left the valves in the wrong position on Three Mile Island. Or maybe it's that somebody wrote a contract for, you know, $20 billion insuring some credit default swaps somewhere, mm-hmm. and nobody ever bothers to check whether that contract was properly priced or what the consequences might be if that bet went bad. And these latent errors sit in the middle of these incredibly complicated systems, and then they may sit there for days, they may sit there for months or even years, and then suddenly something else goes wrong and all the latent errors are revealed. And one of the lessons then, I mean, this is a human problem.
You bet.
One of the lessons is whistleblowing. It's often employees of these big, complex organizations who see that there's a problem and who may want to speak out, but they often don't speak out because they know whistleblowers are often treated very, very badly.
Right, and in fact, you even, this idea of the protecting of knowledge or the suppression of knowledge, that's one of the real, you know, secrets or unknown secrets that we really need to expose, and you do that well in your book, is this idea of how we protect new ideas that matter and allow them, even sometimes, for latent growth or expansion before we can apply them.
Yeah, because so often when we're talking about, you know, really important innovations, it takes a while before it becomes apparent this is really going to work. In the book, I talk about you know, this amazing fighter plane during the Second World War that was really instrumental in turning back the Nazis. That was really, it wasn't Plan A. It wasn't even Plan B.
Right.
It was about Plan Q, something like that. It was way down the pecking order of priorities for the air ministry that was commissioning, you know, different research projects, commissioning different aeroplanes. But in that particular case, there was a guy called Air Commodore Henry Cave Brown Cave. I love this idea. I can imagine this guy with his curly waxed moustache, old British Commodore, who said, yeah, sure, we'll commission this plane. It was called the Spitfire. We'll commission this plane. Why not? It will be a most interesting experiment. And although it was an experiment that didn't seem to have a big chance of success, it only cost about as much as a decent house in central London at the time. You know, it was just a few $100,000 in modern terms. And in the end, it saved the lives of nearly 500,000 Jews and changed the course of the Second World War. And the trouble is, it's really difficult to get big organizations, whether we're talking about governments or businesses, to recognize and put aside those small bets that are not very likely to pay off, but if they do pay off, they can be worth, well, it's incalculable what they can be worth.
Well, the other piece of it is those smaller bets actually may never directly go to an X, but rather influence 50 other things. Of course, the whole journey to space and the amount of technology that's brought and then rippled across various economies and efforts around the world is a classic example of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the space race, I discuss this as well in the book. One of the fascinating things there is the amazing ideas that were funded by governments and then put to one side because, you know, take, for example, the incredible race to put a man on the moon, John F. Kennedy's inspiring vision, and of course, you guys did put a man on the moon and the whole world was watching. But in that push to get a man on the moon, there were other technologies, for instance, trying to piggyback a spacecraft on the back of a larger aeroplane.
Right, exactly.
We're never going to get anybody to the moon, and so they were put to one side. One of the early, there was a program called the X-15 that might eventually have led to launching satellites from the back of aeroplanes, which, you know, potentially is a cheaper and more reliable way of doing it. You can fly around weather problems. One of the early pilots was a guy called Neil Armstrong. I don't know what happened to him.
Right.
But that was put to one side. And it was only many decades later, with a big sort of philanthropic push, that it was rediscovered. And they're now going to use this technology first for space tourism and then, you know, maybe also for launching satellites. Let's hope so.
Yeah, exactly. Tim, the title of your book, Why Success Always Starts with Failure. The point of that title, that whole message, this is about learning, this is about unearthing, like you say, some of those latent ideas that are hidden in the midst of the challenging times?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I discovered, I originally wanted to write a book about how to save the world. You know, and so I made a huge list of all the different problems that people talk about. You're thinking about terrorism and wars, thinking about the financial crisis, thinking about innovation and environmental problems, all of these problems. And so it was going to be this big, worthy policy wonk book about all these different policy proposals to solve all these problems. And as I was talking to people and interviewing people about these ideas, whether I was talking to scientists or poker players or would-be astronauts or serving generals in Iraq, I mean, all kinds of different people, the same theme kept coming up.
Right.
And it was all about, well, yeah, it's complicated. We keep making mistakes. We keep having to fix the mistakes. It's all about how quickly you can spot your mistakes. Can you spot them early enough? Can you fix them fast enough? Anyway, even if you solve a problem, the world changes, and
right.
then the old solution won't deal with the new problem.
Right.
I realized, you know, I'm onto something here. This idea keeps coming up. And you know, there have been some people who say, well, you know, aren't you just saying, you know, learn from your mistakes? Isn't that really old advice? And I sort of sympathize with that. It is old advice, but one of the points I make in the book is when you look at the psychology of it, we don't learn very well from our mistakes. We really struggle to learn from our mistakes, which is why it's become such a cliche. It's why people, you know, don't have to tell us to, you know, tie our shoelaces, or have a drink of water from time to time, but they do have to keep telling us to learn from our mistakes because it's something that we find so terribly, terribly difficult. I mean, I would love, for example, for politicians to be able to stand up and say something like, well, I want to fix our education system, but I don't really know how to do it. I've got 10 ideas. Any one of them might work, but it's a complicated world, and they probably won't all work. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to test them all out. I'm going to run pilots. We'll see what works, and we'll build on it. And the stuff that doesn't work, well, we'll stop it. You know, even though they were my ideas, we'll stop it. We don't want to waste money on stuff that's proven not to work. And I would just love for a politician to be able to stand up and campaign on that platform. And I wish that voters would vote for such a platform.
Well, and the same isn't just...
I don't think it happens.
Right, and it isn't just our politicians, of course. There's a lot of people in the business sector, in the nonprofit sector, anyone that's in a leadership capacity, it's that same challenge. It's how you set aside the ego when you realize you're headed down the wrong path. And, oh, by the way, even at the point of birthing something new to go after complex problems, that if an equal amount of energy, if not more, needs to be spent on helping people let go of how it was done before.
You know, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of this is about the psychology of the thing, the leadership, and a lot of it is about a process of organizational change. I spend a whole chapter in the book, and the chapter, there are long chapters and there are not very many of them, so it's a big chunk of the book, talking about the tragedy of the war in Iraq, what happened and what went wrong, and how was it fixed. Because that seems to me to be an amazing study in organizational behavior. And it's tragic, but it's also heroic. There's some amazing men and women who experienced, they found themselves in this terribly, terribly difficult situation, having to clear up a mess that they did not make and solve problems that they did not cause. And it was fascinating to see who were the people who made the necessary changes, who were the people who changed the tactics that were being used.
Correct.
And it wasn't the people at the top. It was the middle managers. It was colonels, mostly. These guys commanding 3,000, 4,000 men. So they're in a responsible position, but they're also close enough to the action to see what's going on. And when people like Colonel H.R. McMaster or Colonel Sean McFarland, they're both now generals, thank goodness, when they started making changes, it was other colonels who started copying them. The changes didn't go up the pyramid. The senior leadership didn't seem to be very interested. But horizontally, good ideas spread really, really fast because people were saying, hey, well, those guys over there, they seem to have solved the problem. Maybe we can see what they're doing. Maybe we can learn from them. So it was a real case study in who's paying attention and who's willing to learn, who's willing to listen, and just as importantly, who isn't willing to listen.
Well, I think the other piece that just verifies, as always, in situations that your ability to lead up and lead down is one thing, but another thing entirely to lead across. And, you know,
yeah.
That whole peer-to-peer
yeah.
support in the process.
And that was something that General David Petraeus, I think, was very, very good at. I don't mean to minimize his role here. I think the story that's told about Petraeus was he came in, he was in charge in Iraq, and he fixed the problem from the top down. And he did play a huge role in fixing the problem, but he was actually doing so from 7,000 miles away from Iraq and from a position of no particular responsibility. He was sort of organizing this internal insurgency inside the U.S. Army, talking to the media, talking to human rights groups, talking to the State Department, talking to the CIA, just getting everybody to understand how the strategy had to change. And he was really helping to catalyze this peer-to-peer movement in the Army and getting Army officers to share information with each other. So in a way, I think that's far more impressive than the role he's officially credited with, which is, you know, he took charge and he told everyone what to do. And he'd already created that context for institutional change inside the U.S. Army.
You bet, exactly. Took it on. For those of you just turned in, we're speaking with Tim Harford. His most recent book's called Adapt, Why Success Always Starts with Failure. Tim, the sidebar topics are the powerful words in each of those chapters, words like selection, variety, managing variation, changing the rules for success, decoupling, safe experimenting. In our balance here of the quick interview that we've got with you here today, talk about that closing chapter then about, okay, so how do I apply this then to me as the individual level?
So I start with the story of Twyla Tharp, who is a choreographer, quite celebrated. Many, many listeners may know her. And this show she created with Billy Joel about 8 years ago, that was a total disaster.
Exactly.
It was a complete flop.
Yeah.
And the process of incredibly painful change that she went through and somehow managed to turn it into this great success that won a couple of Tony Awards. It ran for years. And you know, what were the psychological challenges that she faced in doing that? Because you know, everybody tries to do that. Everybody tries to fix their mistakes when they're confronted with really harsh criticism, but we find it very hard. So I wanted to build on that story and sort of get people to reflect on their own lives. It's not a self-help book, but it's kind of got that half chapter at the end that's a self-help chapter. Because I didn't originally intend to write that chapter, but writing the rest of the book made me realize I was changing the way I behaved in my own life.
Perfect, yeah.
So I guess there are three things you could say, just briefly. So one is, we need to be more open to new experiences and new ideas. We need to be willing to try new things. And we tend once we've left school or left college, we tend to close down pretty quickly and become much more risk averse. The second thing is we need to get good at taking small bets, taking small risks.
Yeah.
Actually, the psychology of this is, we are disproportionately anxious about small losses. We possibly don't worry as much as we should about really
big ones, exactly.
Because we're in denial about them. But we should be willing to take lots of small risks. A lot of them won't pay off, but that's okay. They were only small risks anyway. And the third thing, and this is the easiest to say, the hardest to do, is to be really honest with yourself about what's working and what's not. And I draw on some of Twyla Tharp's experience, tapping into her network of friends. Actually, it's more than friends, because friends will often tell you what they think you want to hear.
You want to hear, present, yeah.
Because they don't want to hurt your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those are the three things. You know, lots of different ideas, lots of different experiments, making sure the experiments are small and survivable. Whether we're talking about, you know, new friends, new hobbies, you know, going new places, you know, trying new things. And that last one is knowing and being honest about whether you've failed or whether you've succeeded.
Exactly, and wise advice for leaders, public policy makers, as well as us on the individual level. Tim Harford, thank you so very much. His new book, Adapt, Why Success Always Starts with Failures. You can learn more at www.timharford.com. And what a pleasure and real honor it has been to meet the undercover economist from the Financial Times, as well as such a prolific writer and contributor to so many journals and documents around the world. Tim, best of luck to you, and thanks for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Take care. Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, 877-544-2580.